You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. From the Vanities Culture Clash, Language Barrier, a bilingual screenwriter tried to build a bridge between Russia and the West. Vladimir Putin burned it down, by Michael Edov. There are two or three screenwriters in Hollywood who can switch between English and Russian at will, and I am one of them. This is not a self-aggrandizing statement. No evidence suggests I'm a genius in either. Still, I have been writing in both for 30 years, and these are the hardest words I have ever had to write because they feel like lopping off half of my brain in public. As long as Vladimir Putin remains in power, I will not write in Russian anymore. In doing this, I am neither assigning collective responsibility nor weaseling out of it. People and their government are different things, even in a democracy, to say nothing of a dictatorship. Using the famed Soviet salami tactics of reducing freedom one slice at a time, Putin's regime cut off all avenues for electoral reform, then peaceful protest, then any dissent at all. Even calling his war a war is now punishable by prison. Only extra-legal means of change are left, and one cannot demand of Russian people that they go that route, certainly not from Los Angeles. Nor am I exiling Russian from my daily life. My household is and will stay bilingual. I remain sensitive to the moments when anti-Putinism shades into Russia-phobia. I smile at Stephen Colbert's barbs about Putin, but not at the comic accent he adopts to deliver them. I feel a bit sick when the New York Times uncritically quotes a former U.S. official calling Russians organically ruthless. And yes, it was just as offensive to me when Ukraine curbed public use of Russian as part of its national policy, because language is never the enemy. So why am I doing this? Because Russia doesn't want me right now, and I don't want it. My identity as a Russian-American is an accident of history. I am an American Jew born in the Soviet-occupied Baltics. In the words of Hannah Arendt, what remains? The language remains. I grew up on Russian literature, Russian movies, and Russian underground rock music. I felt that I was put on this planet to build a bridge between the two great cultures. I couldn't write like Nabokov or dance like Baryshnikov. Who could? But in 2012, when I found myself working in Moscow after 20 years in the U.S., I finally got a chance to try to build that bridge. All my Russian film and TV work was dedicated to one crushingly simple idea. Russia is part of the world. Leningrad, my first series, was a light-hearted adventure with a subversive feature. Its characters, bilingual Russians in the UK, didn't see themselves as exiles, making it perhaps the first piece of Russian pop culture to present immigration as a casual choice. The Optimist, set in 1960, revolved around a group of young Soviet diplomats with international backgrounds, tasked with explaining the Western mind to older colleagues. Leto, a film I co-wrote with my wife, Lily, worked the other way, exposing the West to the Russian indie rock of my childhood. When it screened at Cannes, with a black tie, Palais de Festival crowd grooving, then sobbing, to the songs of Victor Tsoi, I thought, here was that bridge I've dreamed of building all my life. Even as the screws tightened in the wake of the 2012 protest against Putin's return to the presidency and the 2014 annexation of Crimea, I got away with a lot. None of my scripts were trimmed beyond the global broadcast standards, and perhaps less. The optimist characters smoked like chimneys. At times, the absence of censorship was so glaring, I became paranoid that the state was using me as a kind of human Potemkin village. But something else broke, slowly, imperceptibly, while I was crafting my little bits of cosmopolitan entertainment. The ruling regime was hard at work choking off oxygen to its own country's mind. Over time, I stopped understanding my own audience, or how I could or should address it. Pop culture, which once had an exciting amateurishness about it, now felt slick but stagnant. Everything looked great. The technical side of filmmaking now routinely bested Western European standards and was closing in on Hollywood. But it only served to show how outmoded the interpersonal relationships were, how timid the satire, how backward the values. The more I rifled through the media landscape, the less tethered I felt to the common cultural baseline without which there can be no dialogue between the author and the audience. Men were soulful alcoholics. Women were sex kittens or man-eaters or moms. LGBTQ plus representation was next to non-existent, but at least there was the excuse of the noxious gay propaganda law behind that. The rest was a choice. And it was all so effing white. A gloriously multinational country with a massive Muslim population. Putin's Russia had zero interest in addressing huge swaths of itself. Rarely exploring locations beyond its two largest cities and shoving all non-Slavic actors into caricatured bit parts. In an illustration by Peter Umansky, a bearded man is shown sitting, head in hands, leaning against a slightly ajar door, which is letting in all sorts of images from the outside world, pop culture, war, protest. In my bridge-building fervor, what I wanted to do most was make things whose appeal would be based on the character's own individual quirky humanity. It proved futile. It felt like every good new Russian film or series, and there were many fantastic ones, was primarily about the grand condition of being Russian in the world. Here was a country that was spending almost the entirety of its creative energy relitigating its own image. There would be no Russian worst person in the world, no Russian drive my car. Everything was either our answer to a specific Hollywood title or the author's statement on Russianness. Londongrad was marketed with the tagline, "This is how our guys do it." The promo campaign implying that it was about the Russians not just living in the UK, but somehow triumphing over it. The vehemently anti-totalitarian The Optimist was sold to the public as a hymn to the strength of Soviet diplomacy. In a surreal PR coup, Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, now on international sanctions list, commented approvingly on it. My latest feature, Jet Lag, came out in the summer of 2021. It was meant to be a Noah Baumbach-esque romantic comedy about a middle-class Moscow couple who split up en route to the airport and end up in two separate far-flung love triangles, a pointedly cosmopolitan movie about dislocation. With the action taking place in Berlin, Thailand, Portugal, Detroit, and Cannes, This time, the reaction of the Russian audience was rage. The main characters, who lived in a tiny apartment and flew on low-cost airlines, were seen as part of an amoral, unpatriotic elite. More charitable readings described the film as a satirical indictment of the creative class. Nary a review considered the characters as characters. When you live in a society that devalues individual experience, the individual becomes a symbol, a marker, a statement. Scrub politics out of everything, and everything becomes politics. I am not megalomaniacal enough to think that my exit from the Russian scene constitutes some sort of loss for Russia. It is, if anything, a form of egotistical self-care. I don't know how to speak to a country that's busy destroying its neighbor and itself, so I won't. I thought I'd built a bridge, but when they're sending tanks over it, it's easier to burn it and start again elsewhere. A voice in my head reasonably notes that I didn't give up writing in English or move to Europe when the United States attacked Iraq in a similarly cruel war of choice under a similarly flimsy pretext. The difference is that, as a citizens of a democracy, we had recourse in elections. With Putin's unending rule, the link between the culture and the state is now existential. One must not blame the Russian people for it. It's the only possible outcome of living under a madman's boot for 20-odd years. I would love nothing more than to get back to writing in Russian for the people of free Russia. For now, there's enough work left at home, not least of all to make sure that the same reactionary ebb of culture that always follows tyrants does not reach here. On to the Arts, Mr. Dylan's Dreamhouse. A first peek at Tulsa's treasure-packed Bob Dylan Museum by Douglas Brinkley. Opening photos, a pensive Bob Dylan during a 1963 recording session, and a 1981 concert poster. When news broke in 2016 that Bob Dylan had given his vast archive of recordings and artifacts to the George Kaiser Family Foundation of Tulsa, people were taken aback. Why was this cultural trove going there, of all places? Now we know the answer. That initial cache of Dylanalia has become the cornerstone of an entire museum, the Bob Dylan Center. Recently, I asked the singer-songwriter, who is 80, why he'd chosen Tulsa. "There's more vibrations on the coast, for sure," he explained. "But I'm from Minnesota, and I like the casual hum of the heartland." The BDC will certainly hum. When it opens in May, Dylan's visage on the building's three-story facade will gaze down on downtown Tulsa's popular gathering place, sometimes called Guthrie Green, for Oklahoman Woody Guthrie. But that isn't to suggest the museum is a vanity project. It's indicative, instead, of the cultural moment, a time when our storytellers and renegade visionaries deserve recognition and respect. It's a time to marvel at the fact that a footloose Midwesterner with a guitar who spent 60 years changing minds and changing the culture with his music actually went on to win the Nobel Prize in Literature for having created new poetic expressions within the great American song tradition. Yes, there's the Louis Armstrong House in Queens, which is impressive, but modest. The Museum of Pop Culture in Seattle is partly a shrine to Jimi Hendrix, yet it's fueled not by scholarship as much as pizzazz. Elvis Presley's Graceland draws over 500,000 visitors a year, though it's more spangle than substance. Now comes an institution, a 29,000-square-foot edifice designed by Olson Kundig, devoted to a living musician. And it is a living monument, an entrancing, immersive, take-you-by-the-lapels destination that doubles as a campus for learning and exploring. The BDC doesn't just enshrine the artist. It celebrates the formational figures who made him what he is. The center, a high-tech vessel holding the man's oeuvre as an overview of the man, will be the spiritual home of Dylan, a relentless performer who is forever on the road. When I mentioned that his tour bus was both Man Cave and Treehouse, Dylan's response was typically cryptic. "Man cave, woman cave, a cave is a cave, dark as a dungeon. They don't travel well, no wheels. And the treehouse, that's not it either. Neither one can move my bus. I try to leave it where we can get it quick. Sometimes we use it when I'm not on tour. Someday, perhaps, that magic bus may be parked in Tulsa." The Dylan Center isn't open yet, so let me give you a taste. The spine of the place is the first floor gallery, which will transport museum goers through the Bard's life and career. Visitors will feel swaddled in a cinematic Dylan experience. They will linger in a virtual recording studio. They will be dazzled by galaxies of ephemera. A listening booth will resonate with the sounds of Chuck Berry, Ella Fitzgerald, Buddy Holly, and others who infused the imagination of Robert Zimmerman while he was a student at Minnesota's Hibbing High. There will be a jolting audiovisual trip back to the 1965 Newport Folk Festival when Dylan blasphemously went electric. The archive reading room, full disclosure, it's named after my wife, Anne, and me, we helped as advisors and patrons, is where historians can pore over, say, manuscripts of Dylan's novel Tarantula. or the dime store scrawl-laden notebooks that became the basis for Blood on the Tracks. The archive itself is the center's beating heart. Inside are countless Dylan drawings and paintings, once mere keepsakes that are now being curated as if they were Rauschenbergs or Basquiat's. Archive director Mark Davidson and his team are busy digitizing all of Dylan's music, from studio outtakes to every live performance. The files here brim with bits of audio heaven, reels from a cold Wisconsin winter when Dylan, 19, recorded himself singing folk ditties, vintage tapes of Cynthia Gooding, the radio personality and Beat Generation chronicler who interviewed Dylan just before his first album was released in 1962. Shelves bear thousands of books and records from the estate of folk music anthologist Harry Smith and the storied Izzy Young Library. Young's Folklore Center, which opened in 1957 near NYU, was the vortex of the folk revival launched by budding musicians Joan Baez, Dave Van Ronk, and Eric von Schmidt, and its cluttered offices served as Dylan's private university. Tulsa was already undergoing a cultural renaissance, thanks in large part to the civic and arts largesse of philanthropist Kaiser, an entrepreneur and lifelong Tulsan, when he acquired Dylan's papers and the idea of the BDC took seed. Kane's Ballroom had become the Carnegie Hall of Americana music, the Woody Guthrie Center, the Philbrook Museum of Art, Tulsa Art Center, Lowdown Jazz Club, and other venues helped make the city an economic engine. Last year, the Greenwood Rising Museum was inaugurated, commemorating the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, in which black-owned businesses were savagely torched, killing scores and hospitalizing hundreds. Tulsa has an authenticity that has somehow dissipated in other American music towns. Country legends Garth Brooks, Carrie Underwood, and Vince Gill, Oklahomans all, might conduct business in Nashville, but that city has gone corporate. Their musical souls remain in the Sooner State. Likewise, I grew up in Ohio, and am a proud Buckeye, yet Cleveland's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame doesn't capture the excitement of the music it represents. Austin has lost its weirdness. New Orleans has balked at building a truly serious national jazz museum, which leaves Tulsa as the double cheeseburger jukebox-kicking Americana mecca. The Native American collection at Gilcrease Museum, where Dylan's archive first lived, is a pivotal reason why Dylan, deeply knowledgeable about the saga of indigenous peoples, chose Tulsa. U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo of the Muscogee Nation will be the BDC's first artist in residence. The Guthrie, too, was clearly a lure. Dylan, a close student of Guthrie, had learned along the way about everything from World War I's Green Corn Rebellion to the exodus of Okies during the Great Depression. And Dylan, a musicologist, has long absorbed himself in the Tulsa sound, collaborating with Leon Russell and Jesse Ed Davis, who played on Watching the River Flow. The deeper answer to why Tulsa? Dylan embodies the individualistic Tulsa way ethos. He's a vagabond, a troubadour, the soulful drifter who closes ballrooms after encores with a see you next time farewell. It makes sense that the Dylan Center is located off of Route 66, whose lore he enshrined in his epic song Brownsville Girl, written with Sam Shepard. Dylan has stayed mostly hands-off about the BDC. True, he designed and welded a 16-foot ironwork structure for the entryway, but he won't be attending the opening. Even so, the giant oak tree that is Bob Dylan will reside here, along with a massive root system of artists that influenced him, nearly 100 of whom are represented, from blues icon Robert Johnson to country and western star Hank Williams to comedian Lenny Bruce, who at village nightclubs in the 60s helped prompt Dylan to become an outlaw figure. A final muse who gets his due in Tulsa, English poet William Blake. Whether Dylan is songwriting, sketching, or engaging with religious text, Blake's spirit is ever present. Blake was an evangelizing poet, Dylan told me. You can see it in his paintings and drawings as well. A Blake poem is the writing on the wall. It's the moving finger. He had the dread of life simplified and down pat. So yeah, his work is inspiring in a way that tells you that whatever strange and out-of-the-way thoughts you have are not so strange after all, and that he put it all down before you did. The Monarchy at a Crossroads. Here's this month's cover story, The Queen of Hearts. As Queen Elizabeth II celebrates her Platinum Jubilee, the royal family struggles to control fractures while redefining the firm for a new era. Perhaps no one has better footing, to everyone's surprise, than Camilla, Duchess of Cornwall, by Katie Nickel, with illustrations by Dewey Saunders. Opening illustration, which is combined with a photo montage, Camilla's Moment. From blending Prince Charles's family with her own, children Tom and Laura from her first marriage, to Andrew Parker Bowles, to forming a lasting personal bond with her mother-in-law, the Queen. The Duchess has secured a beloved place in the bosom of the royal family. There was a time not so long ago when the greatest threat to King Charles was Camilla Parker Bowles. Yet with Her Majesty's blessing for Camilla to become Queen Consort when Charles is crowned king, you could now say that the Duchess of Cornwall is one of the monarchy's greatest success stories and a vital pillar of strength for its future. The monarchy looks very different from how it did just 10 years ago at the Diamond Jubilee, following the death of Prince Philip, the Sussexes standing down, and the spectacular fall of the Duke of York, the royal lineup is somewhat depleted. Yet here's Camilla, whose metamorphosis from mistress to my darling wife, as Charles calls her, has been remarkable, a triumph matched perhaps only by Queen Victoria's consort Prince Albert, who transformed himself from mistrusted German outsider to revered royal. Today, Camilla is the second most senior woman in the royal family, after the Queen, who once referred to Camilla as that wicked woman. Now, the monarch enjoys a warm and close relationship with her daughter-in-law, and a bond forged over their mutual love of dogs and horses. Her Majesty's announcement that it was her sincere wish for Camilla to become Queen laid to rest years of endless speculation about Camilla's title when Charles accedes. It was the Queen's way of not only securing a smooth transition for her son's reign, but of showing her support for Camilla, who has been a devoted family member since her wedding to the Prince of Wales in 2005. Back then, the question of Camilla's title was more inflammatory. Through marriage, she was technically the Princess of Wales, but amid fears of a public backlash, Clarence House announced she would be known as the Duchess of Cornwall, and once Charles became king, Princess Consort. There was no inevitability about the Duchess becoming Queen Consort, says Patrick Harrison, who worked in the press office at Clarence House for 14 years and coordinated media plans for Charles and Camilla's wedding. "I'm personally thrilled for her, because she has worked so hard and really hasn't put a foot wrong. She would say, I do it because I love the boss. It's my job to be there by his side. But she has done so much more than that. She is absolutely devoted to the Prince of Wales and to the institution and takes her royal role and duties incredibly seriously. She understands the benefits and the challenges that go with that." Over the years, there have been many challenges. Charles and Camilla's love affair, which Princess Diana blamed for the breakdown of her marriage, seemed doomed. Despite a palace spin campaign to pave the way for Charles and Camilla, there was resistance to their union, and the campaign took a long time to claim success. To many Britons, Camilla would long be the third person in the Wales's marriage, as Diana called her in the infamous BBC interview. Meanwhile, Camilla was also a mother, trying to shelter two teenage children from ruinous tabloid headlines. Her family is her nucleus. She is extremely close to her son Tom, daughter Laura, and 5 grandchildren. She remains on good terms with her ex-husband, Andrew Parker Bowles, and counts her sister Annabel as her best friend. She has a very close and supportive family and a close group of old friends, says her nephew Ben Elliott. She adores her husband, children, and grandchildren. Her family first motto has rubbed off on Charles, who speaks to Prince William almost every day on the phone and is closer than ever to his mother. Behind palace doors, sources say, the Duchess has also been instrumental in trying to heal the fractured relationship between Charles and Prince Harry. The situation with Harry was upsetting for all the family, and we mustn't forget that they are a family, says a friend. I know that Camilla did her best and was a tremendous sounding post and support for Charles, who was deeply troubled. This friend points out what a difficult road Camilla has had with the press and how she was ostracized by the family. She threw a hand of friendship out to Harry and Meghan at various points. When Meghan was going through a difficult time with her own father, Camilla helped navigate things. It was Camilla who told Charles that walking Meghan up the aisle was the right thing to do. She's a very family-oriented woman, and she really wanted to help. Camilla's close friend and Gloucestershire neighbor, Jilly Cooper, an author, says the Duchess has an incredible capacity to take on duties. She always did a lot of charity, but now people are appreciating just how much she does. I think Camilla has climbed Everest in the way she has turned things around. People are now seeing her for who she is, a kind, caring, and fun person. And then there is the support of the Queen. At the Diamond Jubilee celebrations in 2012, the two women rode side by side in a royal carriage procession, which reflected both Camilla's seniority and her closeness to the monarch. The two have only grown closer. I think the Queen has always been very fond of Camilla, says Penny Junior, author of The Duchess. There was a great misconception before Charles and Camilla married that the Queen didn't like her and wanted her out of sight and out of the prince's life. She did want Camilla out of the prince's life, not because she didn't like her personally, but because she could see huge damage being done to the monarchy. But they have, on a personal level, always liked one another and have a great deal in common. Now she sees that Camilla has been a loyal and faithful support to Charles, and she's very grateful to her for that. Publicly, the Queen has bestowed every honor on Camilla, from the royal family order, given at the Queen's discretion as a reward for service, to the Dame Grand Cross of the Royal Victorian Order. The Duchess of Cornwall is also now a member of the Privy Council, the Queen's most senior advisory body, and which plays an important part in the accession ceremonies of a new sovereign. In 2021, it was announced that Camilla was to be invested into the Order of the Garter, the greatest accolade of all. According to another friend of the Duchess, the Garter was the one thing she really wanted, because it is such an enormous privilege. Camilla was absolutely thrilled about it. Says historian Hugo Vickers, everybody wants the Garter. It was the Princess of Wales's secret wish, too. According to her friend Jude Kelly, who founded the women empowerment organization Women of the World, Camilla is not someone trying to push herself forward, but it has become clearer and clearer that because she sits in a place of power where the limelight is on her, she is using that to speak about other people's situations. She's great at putting people at ease, particularly when they think, well, who am I to meet HRH? They're the people she seeks out and asks them about themselves, says Kelly. She's very inclusive in that way. Of course, she's not an ordinary woman, in the sense that she's going to be the queen consort, but she is totally in touch with the ordinary. Amid the dire straits of the pandemic, some of Camilla's most important work came to light, including her commitment to improving literacy and helping the elderly through her work with the charity Silver Stories. She also put the spotlight on domestic violence as patron of the charity Safe Lives, which supports women who have been abused. Elizabeth Carney Hayworth, co-founder of Silver Stories and Operation Encompass, which advocates for children who experience domestic abuse, says the future Queen Consort has made sure not to be silent around the stigma. I can only imagine that being asked to stay there could feel very isolating and frightening for you and your family. It may mean spending more time with the person who is harming you, Camilla wrote in one Instagram message that shared resources and a helpline for victims. If this is your situation, or you are worried about someone else, I want you to know that you are not alone. She also shared reading list with the nation, The Remains of the Day, and A Gentleman in Moscow ranked, and set up a book club on Instagram called The Reading Room. Camilla wanted to actually help people. She knew that people living with cancer were really being affected during that first lockdown. She wanted to understand how we were able to help them and how we as a charity were coping, says Dame Laura Lee, chief executive of the cancer charity Maggie's, of which Camilla is patron. Since COVID restrictions were lifted, the Duchess has been keen to resume royal duties. She and Charles were the first senior royals to go overseas on an official tour to Jordan and Egypt. Hairdresser Geraldine Mancini gave the Duchess a feathery new cut, and alongside the Queen of Jordan, she dazzled in pretty day dresses and tailored coats. The Duchess has really found her style, says Fiona Clare, Camilla's dresser, who has been designing for her nearly 10 years. I wouldn't say she's into clothes, but she has found her niche. She is very elegant, and she knows what works. Her staples are dresses, frock coats, and great hats. She's got a wonderful core team around her with people she trusts and knows will make her look good. While she makes the job look fun and breezy, Camilla finds the overseas travel hard work. She is low maintenance, traveling with a small entourage that includes a private secretary, personal assistant, dresser, and hairdresser. She often does her own makeup and travels lighter than her husband, but she doesn't enjoy flying and can't bear the heat. She sometimes struggles to keep up with the workaholic prince who doesn't break for lunch. From very early on, she clearly said, "I am not going to go at the same pace as the boss," says Harrison. "I'm not going to do 5 engagements a day without any lunch, and then do 2 engagements in the evening. It's just, you know, the boss can do that. I can't." Charles is keen to make sure that his wife doesn't burn out. Their marriage is very much an equal partnership, founded on a deep love and a mutual understanding. They love and respect each other and laugh at the same things, says Elliot. She will always see the absurd in many things and does not take herself too seriously and is very witty. As she approaches her 75th birthday and ever more responsibility, the future surely seems daunting. Camilla has decided she will keep Ray Mill, her Wiltshire home, when she is queen, so that she has a bolt hole to escape the rigidity and scrutiny of palace life. At her home, she can putter around in a dressing gown, cook for her family, and relax. She makes a point of factoring in time for herself in order to maintain a healthy work-life balance, walking, reading, holidaying in Scotland, and being with her family. She loves swimming, especially in the sea in Cornwall, where she and Charles vacation. And she loves to cook and makes a mean roast chicken, according to Tom. A 70-something queen consort talking about difficult issues like domestic violence, rape, and female genital mutilation is, some might say, a queen for the modern world. And while Charles and Camilla may not represent youth and glamour like the Cambridges, together with William and Kate, they formed a new sort of Fab Four. At an age where retirement should be on the horizon, Camilla is in for the long haul, something her family say she is fully willing to embrace. "She is very strong, resilient, and patient," says Elliot. "She is also very committed to supporting her husband in all he does and very forthright in supporting the causes she believes in." When I meet the Duchess at a busy reception at Clarence House on International Women's Day, she is in sparkling form in an emerald Bruce Oldfield coat dress and sensible black suede boots. "She's practical and very determined," says Kelly. "I think as queen that will be very important. And she's clearly a great supporter of Charles. They are a great couple, and I think together they will build a platform for getting society to care about vulnerability." Perhaps Camilla's greatest success is that she has never tried to upstage Charles, nor has she tried to shape the role to her advantage. I think that she proves the power of silence, says Clear. She's found her place, and I think that's partly down to knowing she has been accepted. It's like a ship sailing across the ocean. She's finally got to her destination. Diana's Last Dance. In this excerpt from her new book, The Palace Papers, about the 25 years since Diana's death, Tina Brown describes the impact the princess's press strategy had on her sons. From their earliest childhood, William and Harry were collateral damage in a cold war between their parents, one that could turn hot in front of them in alarming ways. The two-year age gap between them was critical in forging their distinctive worldviews, and equally so in shaping their perceptions of their mother. Prince Harry idolized Diana more and understood her less. He would always be her baby, a scamp who was thick at his lessons and naughty just like me. His emotions, like hers, were always simmering near the surface. William understood Diana more, but idealized her less. He was privy to her volatile love life. He knew the tabloids made her life hell, but he also knew she colluded with them. By his early teens, he was his mother's most trusted confidant. She used to describe him as my little wise old man. Like many women whose relationships with their husbands have become dysfunctional, Diana used her elder son as both a stand-in and a buffer, toting him along for meetings with journalists. Then Daily Mirror editor Piers Morgan describes in his diary a startlingly revealing background lunch with Diana and the 13-year-old William at Kensington Palace in 1996, at which, he says, the princess allowed him to ask literally anything. William insisted on a glass of wine, even when Diana said no, and he seemed thoroughly up to date on all the tabloid rumors about her lovers. He is clearly in the loop on most of her bizarre world, and in particular the various men who come into it from time to time, the astonished Morgan noted. Diana's most recent romantic adventure at that time was with the sturdy hunk Will Carling, captain of the England rugby team, whom she had met in 1995 working out at the Chelsea Harbour Club gym. William hero-worshipped Carling and met him several times with Diana. When Carling visited Kensington Palace for a romantic rendezvous, he gave both boys a rugby shirt. It is unclear when William came to realize that his idol was a sporting visitor in more ways than one. Carling's wife, the television personality Julia Carling, conclusively enlightened him. And everyone else, when rumors of marital difficulties were rife, making it clear the princess was at least one of the reasons. "This has happened to Diana before," Julia told a reporter. "You hope she won't do these things again, but obviously she does." Diana was livid about Julia Carling's comments. "She's milking it for all she's worth, that woman," she told Morgan over lunch. "Honestly, I haven't seen Will since June 95. William interjected, "I keep a photo of Julia Carling on my dartboard at Eton." In the photos, the Princess Diaries. Princess Diana's romances with various men, from rugby player Will Carling to Army officer James Hewitt to surgeon Hasnat Khan, fueled a complicated dynamic with the tabloid press. The exchange reveals much about the dynamic between mother and son. For Diana to include the future heir to the throne at a meeting with one of the royal family's most reckless tabloid tormentors and freely refer to a casual affair was on its face amazing. Try imagining the Duchess of Cambridge and a teenage Prince George doing the same today. It suggests that her boundaries were dissolving, and with them, her judgment. Not only was William used to hearing about her lovers, as Morgan notes, but he'd also found a way to deal with it at school. Tacking Julia Carling's image onto a dartboard was a gesture of loyalty to his mother that also announced he knew exactly what the other boys were whispering about. Time and again, Diana chose to invade her own privacy, often for the capricious reason of making the men in her life jealous. The most unforgettable stolen snap from Diana's last fateful holiday was the famous kiss picture of her in a clinch with bare-chested Dodi Fayed, her playboy lover, off the coast of Corsica. It was she who tipped off Italian linesman Mario Brenna to send a taunting message to the real love of her life, Hasnat Khan. Nicholas Coleridge, former president of Condé Nast International, tells a story in his memoir of inviting Diana to a boardroom lunch at Condé Nast London HQ in 1996. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.